From Genetic Engineering and Biotechnology News, this is the GenCast Network. Bringing you compelling and in-depth interviews with the biotech industry's leading researchers, newsmakers, and thought leaders. This week on the GenCast Network, Dr. Alan Zajac from the University of Alabama at Birmingham is interviewed by Gen's editor-in-chief John Sterling about the discovery of a linkage between an important immune system protein and the body's ability to mount an effective antiviral response.
Dr. Alan Zajac is an associate professor in the Department of Microbiology at the University of Alabama in Birmingham. His primary research interests are how antiviral CD8 T-cell responses are triggered and why those responses may sometimes be ineffective. Dr. Zajac, before we discuss your group's paper in Science, would you talk about the role of CD4 and CD8 T-cells in response to a viral infection?
Well, CD4 and CD8 T-cells are components of the adaptive immune response. They become antigen-specific or they develop into virus-specific responses during the course of infection. And so the physical presence of the cells is required in order to control the infections. And the CD8 T-cells have been typically referred to as the CTL subset, or the cytotoxic T-cells, or the killer T-cells, and the CD4 T-cells are typically thought to be the helper cells. And what these cells do is they act together and also with other components of the immune system to help bring about the control of infections. Now, that can be the complete eradication of the infection, or in certain instances, in terms of chronic infections, they may hold the viral loads at a sort of steady state level over time. And so these cells function in several different ways in order to help control the infections and contain the infections once they become established. Now, one of the other hallmarks of T-cell responses is that they are able to establish what we call immunological memory. So they can have sort of a history of infections that have been previously fought and previously encountered by the host, and if they're encountered again, they can mount bigger, better, and faster responses, and that basically forms the basis of vaccinations as well. One point is important, I think, to stress, though, is the T-cells don't just act alone in combating an infection. They act with other components of the immune system as well, including, for example, antibody responses.
Would you describe specifically how these types of T-cells carry out their antiviral functions?
Yes. The CD8 T-cells, as I said, have been typically called the killer T-cells. And so one way in which they remove virus-infected cells from the host is by killing the virus-infected target cell. They can do this in several ways, but one of the principal ways is to use a molecule called perforin. So the cells, if the infection becomes established, they differentiate into what we call effector cells, and those effector cells gain the ability to kill the virus-infected target cell and can remove it from the host. Now, they also do other functions as well, and one of their major functions is also to produce cytokines, for example, interferon gamma, TNF-alpha, and IL-2. And these cytokines can also sometimes play a role in purging the host from the virus-infected cells. So the CD8 T-cells, you can get really massive CD8 T-cell responses. They can disperse into the tissues where they can act locally to fight the infections off. And after the infection has been controlled, these responses are typically downsized, and then you form a pool of cells that are more stably maintained over time, but at a smaller number than at the effector phase of a response, and that helps confer long-lived immunological memory. Now, the CD4 T-cells have typically been called the helper subset of cells, or the helper T-cells, and one of their principal functions is to help antibody responses by promoting the B-cell responses, promoting germinal center formation, promoting antibody class switching, so you get a good antibody response, and some of that's brought about by having good CD4 T-cell help. But what we appreciate more and more is that the CD4 T-cells don't just act on the antibody responses, but can also help the CD8 T-cell responses. And if you lack or you don't have a good CD4 T-cell response, not only can the antibody responses be impaired, but the CD8 T-cell responses can also be not as good at doing their principal job of controlling the infection. And the both types of immune responses can have a downside. Of course, we can get immunopathology. We can get disease damage to the host cause because of the actions of the immune response as well. So, that's the main features, I think, of the CD4 and CD8 T-cell responses.
Let's pick up on this point a little more. What are the consequences of an ineffective antiviral immune response, and how are diseases like HIV and hepatitis C examples of the immune system's inability to meet these viral challenges?
Right, that's a really good question, because, of course, the ideal situation is to get rid of the infection. And we know the reason we can clear certain infections is because there's a good immune response. The infections don't go away on their own. They go away because we've mounted a good immune response. Or we have mounted a good response because of a vaccination, for example. But some infections, such as hepatitis C and HIV, they're never clear from the host. You can be with them for life, basically. They may never be contained. And one thing that can occur in these situations is you either develop a response that's not as good as you'd like it to be, or the response may initially develop but then fade away over time. And so in these cases of infections that are never brought under control, what we've shown, our own work as well as others, have shown that these diminished responses, they're not as functionally robust. They may not be able to elaborate the full range of effector functions that you'd typically like to see. And we can actually track this in experimental systems where for CD8 T cells, the loss of function is actually quite predictable. And first you either lose or don't get good IL-2 production, and then the ability to produce interferon gamma is slightly more robust but eventually fades away, and also the cells may not be able to proliferate as much. And we know a very good example is HIV infection for CD4 T cells. We lose the CD4 T cells quite profoundly during the initial stages of HIV infection, and one of the consequences of that is you have a host with an impaired or more crippled immune response, probably because of that loss of CD4 T cells, and that's also associated with a weakened CD8 T cell response as well. So during these types of infections, as well as systems that we use in the laboratory, during these persistent infections, the cells can succumb to exhaustion or an altered ability to produce the array of effector functions that you would normally like to see. So our goal is to really try and determine what are the best effector functions and how we can promote those types of responses.
Your work in the Science paper focused on interleukin-21. Just what is interleukin-21, and what is the importance of this molecule in relation to the antiviral immune response?
Right, that's a good question too. Interleukin-21 or IL-21 was first identified in the year 2000. It's a member of a family of cytokines called the common gamma chain family of cytokines. And IL-21 has been documented to have very broad immunological actions, from helping antibody responses to also helping T cell responses. And so given the very broad range of actions that IL-21 has, it's very plausible that it plays an important role in combating viral infections and helping immune responses during the course of an infection. And so when our own work in the Science paper, as well as a closely related report from Dr. Brooks's group at UCLA, implicate IL-21 in helping immune responses being sustained during the context of an ongoing infection.
Where is IL-21 produced, and how exactly does it carry out its job in helping to mount an effective antiviral immune response?
Right, so there's been studies to show that IL-21, one of the principal sources of IL-21, are CD4 T cells, particularly cells of T follicular helper or Th17 lineage. So CD4 T cells are a key player in the production of a cytokine, but other cell types, for example, NK T cells, may also be able to produce a cytokine at some level. So if the principal source, as currently defined, is probably the CD4 T cells, other cell types may play a role. Now, as I mentioned, IL-21 has very broad immunological actions, from promoting B cell responses through to promoting T cell responses and several aspects along the way. What our studies show is that one way in which IL-21 antiviral immune response is by directly acting on the CD8 T cells to kind of promote their ability to continue to function during the context of an ongoing infection. So So that's where one way in which we think IL-21 is acting is by directly sort of imprinting the CD8 T cells in order to be able to do a good job at combating the infection.
Would you describe the experiment your team carried out to demonstrate the significant role for IL-21 in the control of a chronic viral infection?
Sure. Well, we did several series of studies using a mouse system. And so what we did is we infected mice with a virus called lymphocytic chorioamenangitis virus, or LCMV. And one of the properties of the strain which we used for most of the study is that it's very slowly controlled. It's a very difficult infection for the mice to control. But over the period of several months, a normal immunocompetent mouse would be able to bring the infection under control. We also know that if CD4 T cells are not present, the infection's never contained. And so really what we were trying to ask is, well, what's so special about the CD4 T cell responses? And if you don't have those responses, why is the infection never controlled versus being only slowly controlled? And so what we did was to first look and see and compare the clone 13 infection with LCMV, which is the one that's only slowly controlled, versus the infection with a strain of the virus called the Armstrong strain, which is an acute infection and is very rapidly controlled. And we asked the question, is there a difference in the levels of IL-21, or actually in the levels of cells that can produce IL-21? And what we found is there was a greatly reduced number of CD4 T cells capable of producing the cytokine during the course of the infection that's harder for the mouse to control. So the next step we took was to say, okay, if we take mice where the IL-21 gene is knocked out, how do they fend off the clone 13 strain of a virus, the infection that's normally only slowly controlled? And what we found was that those IL-21 deficient mice never control the clone 13 LCMV infection. And their responses actually are very similar to what we would see in a CD4 knockout. So it's almost as though the IL-21 knockout looked almost identical to a CD4 knockout. The IL-21 knockouts do have the CD4 T cells, but the CD8 T cell responses and the course of infection was very similar to what we would see in a CD4 knockout if they were infected with the LCMV clone 13 strain. And what were some of those properties of the responses? Well, one was the loss of CD8 T cell effector functions. Initially, we detected that by the loss of IL-2, but if you wait over time, the cells sort of became completely exhausted, and there was greatly reduced ability to produce TNF, IL-2, and interferon gamma as well. So the mice became persistently infected if the cytokine was absent, and the T cells succumb to exhaustion. That information in itself didn't tell us whether IL-21 was acting directly on the CD8 T cells or not. So we undertook an additional series of studies to ask, where is IL-21 acting? And to do this, we took advantage of another strain of mouse that lacked the IL-21 receptor. And we produced a mixed bone marrow chimeras in this case, where the mouse would end up with a mixture of T cells that could express IL-21 and perceive IL-21 derived signals, versus a set of cells in the same mouse that could not perceive IL-21 on IL-21 derived signals. So we could directly compare now the fates of cells that could detect IL-21 versus those that could not. And when we did that study, what we found was that the cells that could perceive IL-21 derived signals developed and were maintained over time and probably contributed to the control of the infection. Whereas in the same host, if we compared the CD8 T cells that lacked the IL-21 receptor, they did initially respond, but those responses were very rapidly lost. There was a very rapid and pronounced decline of the IL-21 receptor deficient cells. And again, that gives us very good evidence that the IL-21 is acting directly on the CD8 T cells to sustain those responses during the course of an ongoing infection. So the data suggested overall that in a chronic infection, there were fewer CD4 T cells producing IL-21. In the IL-21 deficient mice, the mice become persistently infected. They could never control the infection. That was associated with exhaustion of the CD8 T cell responses, and we think that the IL-21 is acting directly on the CD8 T cells to help them. Now, the last part of the paper, we asked the question, well, what happens if we give the animals IL-21? Does that improve the responses? And the way we undertook that study was to use CD4-deficient mice, because we knew that CD4-deficient mice cannot control the LCMV clone 13 strain, and that CD4 T cells are the principal source of IL-21. So we gave the CD4 knockout mice IL-21, and what we found was that the viral loads were lower by 8 days after infection, 8 to 9 days after infection, the viral loads were lower, and the immune responses were better. So that looked like you take away IL-21, has a negative effect. You add in IL-21, has a very positive effect. But there's a downside to our study, and that was a lot of the mice got very sick once we gave them IL-21, probably because the immune response was actually better and we were getting a phenomenon called immunopathology, where the host basically starts to attack itself because of the viral infection, and the better response is actually detrimental to the host because the host is starting to have a really exuberant response to try and combat the infection. So there's a little bit of caution there, but I think it looked very promising.
Based on your IL-21 research, how might your findings be translated into new antiviral therapeutic opportunities?
Well, I think that's really something that we're very interested in pursuing. Our work where we showed that if we provided the mice with IL-21, improved responses, I think has tremendous potential. But there is obviously some caution because of immunopathology. So what I envisage could occur is maybe IL-21 could be tested as an antiviral drug, especially in the context of more severe infections. But also IL-21, maybe not on its own, but maybe in conjunction with other therapies such as antiviral chemotherapy or the provision of other antiviral or other approaches to boost immune responses, for example, neutralizing IL-10 or PD-1 blockade, maybe in conjunction with other therapies, IL-21 would actually have a very promising effect. Now, we have some clues from that from animal studies that we reported, but I think that's really the steps where I think it holds great promise, actually. But I think we do have to be a little bit cautious along the way because, you know, obviously there can be detrimental effects, and IL-21 is involved in a lot of aspects of the immune response. So, you know, obviously we measure the CD8 T cell responses and we see improvements, but, you know, we don't know all of the implications of therapy. But I think it really is something that could be worked up, and I expect it will be both ourselves and many other groups, I suspect.
I'm John Sterling. Thanks for listening. If you would like to comment on this week's podcast, please go to our podcast section at www.genengnews.com and give us your thoughts. We'd really like to hear from you. Bye for now.
To learn more about topics discussed in this GenCast or to listen to previous GenCasts, visit our website at www.genengnews.com. New GenCasts are posted every week, Thursday, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. For the Gen Publishing editorial staff, I'm Jonathan Ellinghouse saying thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in again next week to the GenCast Network.